Chapter 1 of The Education of Henry Adams by Henry Adams. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Quincy, 1838-1848. Under the shadow of Boston State House, turning its back on the house of John Hancock, the little passage called Hancock Avenue runs, or ran, from Beacon Street, skirting the State House grounds to Mount Vernon Street on the summit of Beacon Hill. And there, in the third house below Mount Vernon Place, February 16, 1838, a child was born, and christened later by his uncle, the minister of the First Church after the tenets of Boston Unitarianism, as Henry Brooks Adams. Had he been born in Jerusalem under the shadow of the temple, and circumcised in the synagogue by his uncle the high priest, under the name of Israel Cohen, he would scarcely have been more distinctly branded, and not much more heavily handicapped in the races of the coming century, in running for such stakes as the century was to offer. But on the other hand, the ordinary traveller, who does not enter the field of racing, finds advantage in being, so to speak, ticketed through life, with the safeguards of an old established traffic. Safeguards are often irksome, but sometimes convenient, and if one needs them at all, one is apt to need them badly. 100 years earlier, such safeguards as his would have secured any young man's success, and although in 1838 their value was not very great compared with what they could have had in 1738, yet the mere accident of starting a 20th-century career from a nest of associations so colonial, so troglodytic as the First Church, the Boston State House, Beacon Hill, John Hancock and John Adams, Mount Vernon Street and Quincy, all crowding on 10 pounds of unconscious babyhood, was so queer as to offer a subject of curious speculation to the baby long after he had witnessed the solution. What could become of such a child of the 17th and 18th centuries, when he should wake up to find himself required to play the game of the 20th? Had he been consulted, would he have cared to play the game at all, holding such cards as he held, and suspecting that the game was to be one of which neither he nor anyone else back to the beginning of time knew the rules, or the risks, or the stakes? He was not consulted, and was not responsible. But had he been taken into the confidence of his parents, he would certainly have told them to change nothing as far as concerned him. He would have been astounded by his own luck. Probably no child born in the year held better cards than he. Whether life was an honest game of chance, or whether the cards were marked and forced, he could not refuse to play his excellent hand. He could never make the usual plea of irresponsibility. He accepted the situation as though he had been a party to it, and under the same circumstances would do it again, the more readily for knowing the exact values. To his life as a whole he was a consenting, contracting party and partner from the moment he was born to the moment he died. Only with that understanding, as a consciously assenting member in full partnership with the society of his age, had his education an interest to himself, or to others. As it happened, he never got to the point of playing the game at all. He lost himself in the study of it, watching the errors of the players. But this is the only interest in the story, which otherwise has no moral and little incident. A story of education, 70 years of it, the practical value remains to the end in doubt, like other values about which men have disputed since the birth of Cain and Abel. But the practical value of the universe has never been stated in dollars. Although everyone cannot be a gargantuan Napoleon Bismarck and walk off with the great bells of Notre Dame, everyone must bear his own universe, and most persons are moderately interested in learning how their neighbors have managed to carry theirs. This problem of education, started in 1838, went on for 3 years, while the baby grew, like other babies, unconsciously, as a vegetable, the outside world working as it never had worked before, to get his new universe ready for him. Often in old age he puzzled over the question whether, on the doctrine of chances, he was at liberty to accept himself or his world as an accident. No such accident had ever happened before in human experience. For him alone the old universe was thrown into the ash-heap, and a new one created. He and his 18th-century troglodytic Boston were suddenly cut apart, separated forever, in act, if not in sentiment, by the opening of the Boston and Albany Railroad, the appearance of the first Cunard steamers in the bay, and the telegraphic messages which carried from Baltimore to Washington the news that Henry Clay and James K. Polk were nominated for the presidency. This was in May 1844. He was 6 years old. His new world was ready for use, and only fragments of the old met his eyes. Of all this that was being done to complicate his education, he knew only the color of yellow. He first found himself sitting on a yellow kitchen floor in strong sunlight. He was 3 years old when he took this earliest step in education, a lesson of color. The second followed soon, a lesson of taste. On December 3, 1841, he developed scarlet fever. For several days he was as good as dead, reviving only under the careful nursing of his family. When he began to recover strength, about January 1, 1842, his hunger must have been stronger than any other pleasure or pain, for while in after life he retained not the faintest recollection of his illness, he remembered quite clearly his aunt entering the sick-room bearing in her hand a saucer with a baked apple. The order of impressions retained by memory might naturally be that of color and taste, although one would rather suppose that the sense of pain would be first to educate. In fact, the third recollection of that child was that of discomfort. The moment he could be removed, he was bundled up in blankets and carried from the little house in Hancock Avenue to a larger one which his parents were to occupy for the rest of their lives in the neighboring Mount Vernon Street. The season was midwinter, January 10, 1842. And he never forgot his acute distress for want of air under his blankets, or the noises of moving furniture. As a means of variation from a normal type, sickness in childhood ought to have a certain value not to be classed under any fitness or unfitness of natural selection, and especially scarlet fever affected boys seriously, both physically and in character, though they might, through life, puzzle themselves to decide whether it had fitted or unfitted them for success. But this fever of Henry Adams took greater and greater importance in his eyes, from the point of view of education, the longer he lived. At first the effect was physical. He fell behind his brothers, 2 or 3 inches in height, and proportionally in bone and weight. His character and processes of mind seemed to share in this fining down process of scale. He was not good in a fight, and his nerves were more delicate than boys' nerves ought to be. He exaggerated these weaknesses as he grew older. The habit of doubt, of distrusting his own judgment, and of totally rejecting the judgment of the world, the tendency to regard every question as open, the hesitation to act except as a choice of evils, the shirking of responsibility, the love of line, form, quality, the horror of ennui, the passion for companionship and the antipathy to society. All these are well-known qualities of New England character, in no way peculiar to individuals, but in this instance they seemed to be stimulated by the fever, and Henry Adams could never make up his mind whether, on the whole, the change of character was morbid or healthy, good or bad for his purpose. His brothers were the type. He was the variation. As far as the boy knew, the sickness did not affect him at all, and he grew up in excellent health, bodily and mental, taking life as it was given, accepting its local standards without a difficulty, and enjoying much of it as keenly as any other boy of his age. He seemed to himself quite normal, and his companions seemed always to think him so. Whatever was peculiar about him was education, not character, and came to him directly and indirectly as a result of that 18th-century inheritance which he took with his name. The atmosphere of education in which he lived was colonial, revolutionary, almost Cromwellian, as though he were steeped from his greatest grandmother's birth in the odor of political crime. Resistance to something was the law of New England nature. The boy looked out on the world with the instinct of resistance. For numberless generations his predecessors had viewed the world chiefly as a thing to be reformed, filled with evil forces to be abolished, and they saw no reason to suppose that they had wholly succeeded in the abolition. The duty was unchanged. That duty implied not only resistance to evil, but hatred of it. Boys naturally look on all force as an enemy, and generally find it so. But the New Englander, whether boy or man, in his long struggle with a stingy or hostile universe, has learned also to love the pleasure of hating. His joys were few. Politics, as a practice, whatever its professions, had always been the systematic organization of hatreds. and Massachusetts politics had been as harsh as the climate. The chief charm of New England was harshness of contrasts and extremes of sensibility, a cold that froze the blood and a heat that boiled it, so that the pleasure of hating, oneself if no better victim offered, was not its rarest amusement, but the charm was a true and natural child of the soil, not a cultivated weed of the ancients. The violence of the contrast was real and made the strongest motive of education. The double exterior nature gave life its relative values. Winter and summer, cold and heat, town and country, force and freedom, marked two modes of life and thought, balanced like lobes of the brain. Town was winter confinement, school, rule, discipline, straight gloomy streets, piled with 6 feet of snow in the middle, frosts that made the snow sing under wheels or runners, thaws when the streets became dangerous to cross, society of uncles, aunts, and cousins who expected children to behave themselves, and who were not always gratified. Above all else, winter represented the desire to escape and go free. Town was restraint, law, unity. Country, only 7 miles away, was liberty, diversity, outlawry, the endless delight of mere sense impressions given by nature for nothing, and breathed by boys without knowing it. Boys are wild animals, rich in the treasures of sense, but the New England boy has a wider range of emotions than boys of more equable climates. He felt his nature crudely, as it was meant. To the boy Henry Adams, summer was drunken. Among senses, smell was the strongest. Smell of hot pine woods and sweet fern in the scorching summer noon, of new-mown hay, of ploughed earth, of box hedges, of peaches, lilacs, syringes, of stables, barns, cowyards, of salt water and low tide on the marshes. Nothing came amiss. Next to smell came taste, and the children knew the taste of everything they saw or touched, from pennyroyal and flag root to the shell of a pignut and the letters of a spelling book, the taste of A, B, Ab, suddenly revived on the boy's tongue 60 years afterwards. Light, line, and color, as sensual pleasures, came later, and were as crude as the rest. The New England light is glare, and the atmosphere harshens color. The boy was a full man before he ever knew what was meant by atmosphere. His idea of pleasure in light was the blaze of a New England sun. His idea of color was a peony, with the dew of early morning on its petals. The intense blue of the sea, as he saw it a mile or two away from the Quincy Hills, the cumuli in a June afternoon sky, the strong reds and greens and purples of colored prints and children's books, as the American colors then ran, these were ideals. The opposites or antipathies were the cold grays of November evenings and the thick, muddy thaws of Boston winter. With such standards, the Bostonian could not but develop a double nature. Life was a double thing. After a January blizzard, the boy who could look with pleasure into the violent snow-glare of the cold, white sunshine, with its intense light and shade, scarcely knew what was meant by tone. He could reach it only by education. Winter and summer, then, were two hostile lives, and bred two separate natures. Winter was always the effort to live. Summer was tropical license. Whether the children rolled in the grass, or waded in the brook, or swam in the salt ocean, or sailed in the bay, or fished for smelts in the creeks, or netted minnows in the salt marshes, or took to the pine woods and the granite quarries, or chased muskrats and hunted snapping turtles in the swamps, or mushrooms or nuts on the autumn hills, summer and country were always sensual living, while winter was always compulsory learning. Summer was the multiplicity of nature. Winter was school. The bearing of the two seasons on the education of Henry Adams was no fancy. It was the most decisive force he ever knew. It ran through life and made the division between its perplexing, warring, irreconcilable problems, irreducible opposites, with growing emphasis to the last year of study. From earliest childhood the boy was accustomed to feel that for him life was double. Winter and summer, town and country, law and liberty, were hostile, and the man who pretended they were not was, in his eyes, a schoolmaster, that is, a man employed to tell lies to little boys. Though Quincy was but 2 hours' walk from Beacon Hill, it belonged in a different world. For 200 years every Adams, from father to son, had lived within sight of State Street, and sometimes had lived in it, Yet none had ever taken kindly to the town, or been taken kindly by it. The boy inherited his double nature. He knew as yet nothing about his great-grandfather, who had died a dozen years before his own birth. He took for granted that any great-grandfather of his must always have been good, and his enemies wicked. But he divined his great-grandfather's character from his own. Never for a moment did he connect the two ideas of Boston and John Adams. They were separate and antagonistic. The idea of John Adams went with Quincy. He knew his grandfather, John Quincy Adams, only as an old man of 75 or 80, who was friendly and gentle with him, but except that he heard his grandfather always called the President, and his grandmother the Madam, he had no reason to suppose that his Adams grandfather differed in character from his Brooks grandfather, who was equally kind and benevolent. He liked the Adams side best, but for no other reason than that it reminded him of the country, the summer, and the absence of restraint. Yet he felt also that Quincy was in a way inferior to Boston, and that socially Boston looked down on Quincy. The reason was clear enough even to a 5-year-old child. Quincy had no Boston style. Little enough style had either. A simpler manner of life and thought could hardly exist short of cave-dwelling. The flint and steel with which his grandfather Adams used to light his own fires in the early morning was still on the mantelpiece of his study. The idea of a livery or even a dress for servants, or of an evening toilette, was next to blasphemy. Bathrooms, water supplies, lighting, heating, and the whole array of domestic comforts were unknown at Quincy. Boston had already a bathroom, a water supply, a furnace, and gas. The superiority of Boston was evident, but a child liked it no better for that. The magnificence of his grandfather Brooks's house in Pearl Street or South Street has long ago disappeared, but perhaps his country house at Medford may still remain to show what impressed the mind of a boy in 1845 with the idea of city splendor. The President's place at Quincy was the larger and older and far the more interesting of the two, but a boy felt at once its inferiority in fashion. It showed plainly enough its want of wealth. It smacked of colonial age, but not of Boston style or plush curtains. To the end of his life he never quite overcame the prejudice thus drawn in with his childish breath. He never could compel himself to care for 19th-century style. He was never able to adopt it, any more than his father or grandfather or great-grandfather had done. Not that he felt it as particularly hostile, for he reconciled himself to much that was worse, but because, for some remote reason, he was born an 18th-century child. The old house at Quincy was 18th-century. What style it had was in its Queen Anne mahogany panels and its Louis XVI chairs and sofas. The panels belonged to an old colonial vassal who built the house. The furniture had been brought back from Paris in 1789 or 1801 or 1817, along with porcelain and books and much else of old diplomatic remnants. And neither of the two 18th-century styles, neither English Queen Anne nor French Louis XVI, was comfortable for a boy or for anyone else. The dark mahogany had been painted white to suit daily life in winter gloom. Nothing seemed to favor, for a child's objects, the older forms. On the contrary, most boys, as well as grown-up people, preferred the new, with good reason, and the child felt himself distinctly at a disadvantage for the taste. Nor had personal preference any share in his bias. The Brooks grandfather was as amiable and as sympathetic as the Adams grandfather. Both were born in 1767, and both died in 1848. Both were kind to children, and both belonged rather to the 18th than to the 19th centuries. The child knew no difference between them, except that one was associated with winter and the other with summer, one with Boston, the other with Quincy. Even with Medford, the association was hardly easier. Once, as a very young boy, he was taken to pass a few days with his grandfather Brooks under charge of his aunt, but became so violently homesick that within 24 hours he was brought back in disgrace. Yet he could not remember ever being seriously homesick again. The attachment to Quincy was not altogether sentimental or wholly sympathetic. Quincy was not a bed of thornless roses. Even there the curse of Cain set its mark. There, as elsewhere, a cruel universe combined to crush a child. As though 3 or 4 vigorous brothers and sisters, with the best will, were not enough to crush any child, every one else conspired toward an education which he hated. From cradle to grave, this problem of running order through chaos, direction through space, discipline through freedom, unity through multiplicity, has always been, and must always be, the task of education, as it is the moral of religion, philosophy, science, art, politics, and economy. But a boy's will is his life, and he dies when it is broken, as the colt dies in harness, taking a new nature in becoming tame. Rarely has the boy felt kindly toward his tamers. Between him and his master has always been war. Henry Adams never knew a boy of his generation to like a master, and the task of remaining on friendly terms with one's own family in such a relation was never easy. All the more singular it seemed afterward to him that his first serious contact with the President should have been a struggle of will, in which the old man almost necessarily defeated the boy, but instead of leaving, as usual in such defeats, a lifelong sting, left rather an impression of as fair treatment as could be expected from a natural enemy. The boy met seldom with such restraint. He could not have been much more than 6 years old at the time, 7 at the utmost, and his mother had taken him to Quincy for a long stay with the President during the summer. What became of the rest of his family he quite forgot, but he distinctly remembered standing at the house door one summer morning in a passionate outburst of rebellion against going to school. Naturally, his mother was the immediate victim of his rage. That is what mothers are for, and boys also. But in this case the boy had his mother at unfair disadvantage, for she was a guest, and had no means of enforcing obedience. Henry showed a certain tactical ability by refusing to start, and he met all efforts at compulsion by successful, though too vehement, protest. He was in fair way to win, and was holding his own, with sufficient energy, at the bottom of the long staircase which led up to the door of the President's library, when the door opened, and the old man slowly came down. Putting on his hat, he took the boy's hand without a word, and walked with him, paralyzed by awe, up the road to the town. After the first moments of consternation at this interference in a domestic dispute, the boy reflected that an old gentleman close on 80 would never trouble himself to walk near a mile on a hot summer morning over a shadeless road to take a boy to school, and that it would be strange if a lad imbued with the passion of freedom could not find a corner to dodge around somewhere before reaching the school door. Then and always the boy insisted that this reasoning justified his apparent submission. But the old man did not stop, and the boy saw all his strategical points turned, one after another, until he found himself seated inside the school, and obviously the center of curious, if not malevolent, criticism. Not till then did the President release his hand and depart. The point was that this act, contrary to the inalienable rights of boys, and nullifying the social compact, ought to have made him dislike his grandfather for life. He could not recall that it had this effect, even for a moment. With a certain maturity of mind, the child must have recognized that the President, though a tool of tyranny, had done his disreputable work with a certain intelligence. He had shown no temper, no irritation, no personal feeling, and had made no display of force. Above all, he had held his tongue. During their long walk he had said nothing. He had uttered no syllable of revolting cant about the duty of obedience and the wickedness of resistance to law. He had shown no concern in the matter. Hardly even a consciousness of the boy's existence. Probably his mind at that moment was actually troubling itself little about his grandson's iniquities, and much about the iniquities of President Polk. But the boy could scarcely, at that age, feel the whole satisfaction of thinking that President Polk was to be the vicarious victim of his own sins, and he gave his grandfather credit for intelligent silence. For this forbearance he felt instinctive respect. He admitted force as a form of right. He admitted even temper under protest. But the seeds of a moral education would at that moment have fallen on the stoniest soil in Quincy, which is, as everyone knows, the stoniest glacial and tidal drift known in any Puritan land. Neither party to this momentary disagreement can have felt rancor, for during these 3 or 4 summers the old President's relations with the boy were friendly and almost intimate. Whether his older brothers and sisters were still more favored, he failed to remember. But he was himself admitted to a sort of familiarity which, when in his turn he had reached old age, rather shocked him, for it must have sometimes tried the President's patience. He hung about the library, handled the books, deranged the papers, ransacked the drawers, searched the old purses and pocket-books for foreign coins, drew the sword-cane, snapped the traveling pistols, upset everything in the corners, and penetrated the President's dressing-closet where a row of tumblers, inverted on the shelf, covered caterpillars which were supposed to become moths or butterflies, but never did. The madam bore with fortitude the loss of the tumblers, which her husband purloined for these hatcheries, but she made protest when he carried off her best cut-glass bowls to plant with acorns or peach-stones that he might see the roots grow, but which, she said, he commonly forgot, like the caterpillars. At that time the President rode the hobby of tree-culture, and some fine old trees should still remain to witness it, unless they have been improved off the ground. But his was a restless mind, and although he took his hobby seriously, and would have been annoyed had his grandchild asked whether he was bored like an English duke, he probably cared more for the processes than for the results, so that his grandson was saddened by the sight and smell of peaches and pears, the best of their kind, which he brought up from the garden to rot on his shelves for seed. With the inherited virtues of his Puritan ancestors, the little boy Henry conscientiously brought up to him, in his study, the finest peaches he found in the garden, and ate only the less perfect. Naturally he ate more, by way of compensation, but the act showed that he bore no grudge. As for his grandfather, it is even possible that he may have felt a certain self-reproach for his temporary role of the schoolmaster, seeing that his own career did not offer proof of the worldly advantages of docile obedience. For there still exists somewhere a little volume of critically edited nursery rhymes, with the boy's name in full written in the President's trembling hand on the fly-leaf. Of course there was also the Bible, given to each child at birth, with the proper inscription in the President's hand on the fly-leaf, while their grandfather Brooks supplied the silver mugs. So many Bibles and silver mugs had to be supplied that a new house or cottage was built to hold them. It was on the hill, 5 minutes' walk above the old house, with a far view eastward over Quincy Bay and northward over Boston. Till his 12th year the child passed his summers there, and his pleasures of childhood mostly centered in it. Of education he had as yet little to complain. Country schools were not very serious. Nothing stuck to the mind except home impressions, and the sharpest were those of kindred children. But, as influences that warped a mind, none compared with the mere effect of the back of the President's bald head, as he sat in his pew on Sundays, in line with that of President Quincy, who, though some 10 years younger, seemed to children about the same age. Before railways entered the New England town, every parish church showed half a dozen of these leading citizens, with grey hair, who sat on the main aisle in the best pews, and had sat there, or in some equivalent dignity, since the time of St. Augustine, if not since the glacial epoch. It was unusual for boys to sit behind a President grandfather and to read over his head the tablet in memory of a President great-grandfather who had pledged his life, his fortune, and his sacred honor to secure the independence of his country, and so forth. But boys naturally supposed, without much reasoning, that other boys had the equivalent of President grandfathers, and that churches would always go on with the bald-headed leading citizens on the main aisle and Presidents or their equivalents on the walls. The Irish gardener once said to the child, "You'll be thinking you'll be President, too." The causality of the remark made so strong an impression on his mind that he never forgot it. He could not remember ever to have thought on the subject. To him, that there should be a doubt of his being President was a new idea. What had been would continue to be. He doubted neither about Presidents nor about churches, and no one suggested at that time a doubt whether a system of society which had lasted since Adam would outlast one Adam's more. The madam was a little more remote than the President, but more decorative. She stayed much in her own room with the Dutch tiles, looking out on her garden with the box walks, and seemed a fragile creature to a boy who sometimes brought her a note or a message, and took distinct pleasure in looking at her delicate face under what seemed to him very becoming caps. He liked her refined figure, her gentle voice and manner, her vague effect of not belonging there, but to Washington or to Europe, like her furniture and writing-desk, with little glass doors above and little 18th-century volumes in old binding labelled Peregrine Pickle or Tom Jones or Hannah More. Try as she might, the madam could never be Bostonian, and it was her cross in life, but to the boy it was her charm. Even at that age he felt drawn to it. The madam's life had been, in truth, far from Boston. She was born in London, in 1775, daughter of Joshua Johnson, an American merchant, brother of Governor Thomas Johnson, of Maryland, and Catherine Knuth, of an English family in London. Driven from England by the Revolutionary War, Joshua Johnson took his family to Nantes, where they remained till the peace. The girl, Louisa Catherine, was nearly 10 years old when brought back to London, and her sense of nationality must have been confused, but the influence of the Johnsons and the services of Joshua obtained for him from President Washington the appointment of consul in London on the organization of the government in 1790. In 1794, President Washington appointed John Quincy Adams minister to The Hague. He was 27 years old when he returned to London, and found the consul's house a very agreeable haunt. Louisa was then 20. At that time, and long afterwards, the consul's house, far more than the minister's, was the center of contact for traveling Americans, either official or other. The legation was a shifting point between 1785 and 1815, but the consulate, far down in the city, near the tower, was convenient and inviting. So inviting that it proved fatal to young Adams. Louisa was charming, like a Romney portrait, but among her many charms, that of being a New England woman was not one. The defect was serious. Her future mother-in-law, Abigail, a famous New England woman whose authority over her turbulent husband, the second president, was hardly so great as that which she exercised over her son, the sixth to be, was troubled by the fear that Louisa might not be made of stuff stern enough, or brought up in conditions severe enough, to suit a New England climate, or to make an efficient wife for her paragon son. And Abigail was right on that point, as on most others where sound judgment was involved. But sound judgment is sometimes a source of weakness rather than of force, and John Quincy already had reason to think that his mother held sound judgments on the subject of daughters-in-law, which human nature, since the fall of Eve, made Adams helpless to realize. Being 3,000 miles away from his mother, and equally far in love, he married Louisa in London, July 26, 1797, and took her to Berlin to be the head of the United States Legation. During 3 or 4 exciting years, the young bride lived in Berlin. Whether she was happy or not, whether she was content or not, whether she was socially successful or not, her descendants did not surely know. But in any case, she could by no chance have become educated there for a life in Quincy or Boston. In 1801, the overthrow of the Federalist Party drove her and her husband to America, and she became at last a member of the Quincy household. But by that time her children needed all her attention, and she remained there, with occasional winters in Boston and Washington, till 1809. Her husband was made senator in 1803, and in 1809 was appointed minister to Russia. She went with him to St. Petersburg, taking her baby, Charles Francis, born in 1807, but broken-hearted at having to leave her two older boys behind. The life at St. Petersburg was hardly gay for her. They were far too poor to shine in that extravagant society. But she survived it, though her little baby girl did not. And in the winter of 1814-15, alone with the boy of 7 years old, crossed Europe from St. Petersburg to Paris in her travelling carriage, passing through the armies and reaching Paris in the Cent Jours after Napoleon's return from Elba. Her husband next went to England as minister, and she was for 2 years at the court of the regent. In 1817 her husband came home to be Secretary of State, and she lived for 8 years in F Street, doing her work of entertainer for President Monroe's administration. Next, she lived 4 miserable years in the White House. When that chapter was closed in 1829, she had earned the right to be tired and delicate, but she still had 15 years to serve as wife of a member of the House, after her husband went back to Congress in 1833. Then it was that the little Henry, her grandson, first remembered her, from 1843 to 1848, sitting in her panelled room at breakfast with her heavy silver teapot and sugar bowl and cream jug, which still exists somewhere as an heirloom of the modern safety vault. By that time she was 70 years old or more, and thoroughly weary of being beaten about a stormy world. To the boy she seemed singularly peaceful, a vision of silver grey presiding over her old president and her Queen Anne mahogany, an exotic like her Sèvres china, an object of deference to everyone, and of great affection to her son Charles, but hardly more Bostonian than she had been 50 years before on her wedding day, in the shadow of the Tower of London. Such a figure was even less fitted than that of her old husband, the President, to impress on a boy's mind the standards of the coming century. She was Louis XVI, like the furniture. The boy knew nothing of her interior life, which had been, as the venerable Abigail, long since at peace, foresaw, one of severe stress and little pure satisfaction. He never dreamed that from her might come some of those doubts and self-questionings, those hesitations, those rebellions against law and discipline, which marked more than one of her descendants. But he might even then have felt some vague, instinctive suspicion that he was to inherit from her the seeds of the primal sin, the fall from grace, the curse of Abel, that he was not of pure New England stock, but half exotic. As a child of Quincy, he was not a true Bostonian, but even as a child of Quincy, he inherited a quarter taint of Maryland blood. Charles Francis, half Marylander by birth, had hardly seen Boston till he was 10 years old, when his parents left him there at school in 1817, and he never forgot the experience. He was to be nearly as old as his mother had been in 1845, before he quite accepted Boston, or Boston quite accepted him. A boy who began his education in these surroundings, with physical strength inferior to that of his brothers, and with a certain delicacy of mind and bone, ought rightly to have felt at home in the 18th century, and should, in proper self-respect, have rebelled against the standards of the 19th. The atmosphere of his first 10 years must have been very like that of his grandfather at the same age, from 1767 till 1776, barring the Battle of Bunker Hill. And even as late as 1846, the Battle of Bunker Hill remained actual. The tone of Boston society was colonial. The true Bostonian always knelt in self-abasement before the majesty of English standards. Far from concealing it as a weakness, he was proud of it as his strength. The 18th century ruled society long after 1850. Perhaps the boy began to shake it off rather earlier than most of his mates. Indeed, this prehistoric stage of education ended rather abruptly with his 10th year. One winter morning he was conscious of a certain confusion in the house in Mount Vernon Street, and gathered, from such words as he could catch, that the President, who happened to be then staying there on his way to Washington, had fallen and hurt himself. Then he heard the word paralysis. After that day he came to associate the word with the figure of his grandfather, in a tall-backed invalid armchair, on one side of the spare bedroom fireplace, and one of his old friends, Dr. Parkman, or P.P.F. de Grand, on the other side, both dozing. The end of this first, or ancestral and revolutionary chapter, came on February 21, 1848, and the month of February brought life and death as a family habit, when the 18th century, as an actual and living companion, vanished. If the scene on the floor of the house, when the old President fell, struck the still simple-minded American public with a sensation unusually dramatic, its effect on a 10-year-old boy, whose boy life was fading away with the life of his grandfather, could not be slight. One had to pay for revolutionary patriots. Grandfathers and grandmothers, presidents, diplomats, Queen Anne mahogany and Louis XVI chairs, as well as for Stuart portraits. Such things warp young life. Americans commonly believed that they ruined it, and perhaps the practical common sense of the American mind judged right. Many a boy might be ruined by much less than the emotions of the funeral service in the Quincy Church, with its surroundings of national respect and family pride. By another dramatic chance, it happened that the clergyman of the parish, Dr. Lunt, was an unusual pulpit orator, the ideal of a somewhat austere intellectual type, such as the school of Buckminster and Channing inherited from the old congregational clergy. His extraordinarily refined appearance, his dignity of manner, his deeply cadenced voice, his remarkable English and his fine appreciation, gave to the funeral service a character that left an overwhelming impression on the boy's mind. He was to see many great functions, funerals and festivals, in afterlife, till his only thought was to see no more. But he never again witnessed anything nearly so impressive to him as the last services at Quincy over the body of one president and the ashes of another. The effect of the Quincy service was deepened by the official ceremony which afterward took place in Faneuil Hall, when the boy was taken to hear his uncle, Edward Everett, deliver a eulogy. Like all Mr. Everett's orations, it was an admirable piece of oratory, such as only an admirable orator and scholar could create. Too good for a 10-year-old boy to appreciate at its value. But already the boy knew that the dead President could not be in it, and had even learned why he would have been out of place there, for knowledge was beginning to come fast. The shadow of the War of 1812 still hung over State Street. The shadow of the Civil War to come had already begun to darken Faneuil Hall. No rhetoric could have reconciled Mr. Everett's audience to his subject. How could he say there, to an assemblage of Bostonians in the heart of mercantile Boston, that the only distinctive mark of all the Adamses, since old Sam Adams's father, 150 years before, had been their inherited quarrel with State Street, which had again and again broken out into riot, bloodshed, personal feuds, foreign and civil war, wholesale banishments and confiscations, until the history of Florence was hardly more turbulent than that of Boston? How could he whisper the word Hartford Convention before the men who had made it? What could have been said had he suggested the chance of secession and civil war? Thus already, at 10 years old, the boy found himself standing face to face with a dilemma that might have puzzled an early Christian. What was he? Where was he going? Even then he felt that something was wrong, but he concluded that it must be Boston. Quincy had always been right, for Quincy represented a moral principle, the principle of resistance to Boston. His Adams ancestors must have been right, since they were always hostile to State Street. If State Street was wrong, Quincy must be right. Turn the dilemma as he pleased, he still came back on the 18th century and the law of resistance, of truth, of duty, and of freedom. He was a 10-year-old priest and politician. He could, under no circumstances, have guessed what the next 50 years had in store, and no one could teach him. But sometimes, in his old age, he wondered, and could never decide, whether the most clear and certain knowledge would have helped him. Supposing he had seen a New York stock list of 1900, and had studied the statistics of railways, telegraphs, coal, and steel, would he have quitted his 18th century, his ancestral prejudices, his abstract ideals, his semi-clerical training, and the rest, in order to perform an expiatory pilgrimage to State Street, and ask for the fatted calf of his grandfather Brooks and a clerkship in the Suffolk Bank? 60 years afterwards, he was still unable to make up his mind. Each course had its advantages, but the material advantages, looking back, seemed to lie wholly in State Street. End of chapter 1.